Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Good morning. Today is the day. This is the day the Lord has made. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of October, 2019. I have like six things I want to start with, but I don't have time for six. So I'm going to start with this. You heard there in the headline news at the top of the hour that we are dealing in this nation with a tremendous rise, exponential rise in teen suicide. And teen suicide doesn't just touch non-Christian families. And so I want to just appeal to you today to reach out to young people and talk to them and just come straight out and say, this is what I said to my 14 and 16-year-old yesterday after we received the news that a family in our community is now dealing with death by suicide of their teenage daughter. And I just came right out and said, I said, look, you guys have to talk to us. If there's something making you so sad or making you question so deeply your value, your worth, your life, the God who gave you breath, you have to talk to us. You have to say something. If you are that sad, you have to tell someone. And so let me just appeal to those of you who are listening today, your family has been touched by this particular variety of deeply tragic grief. The rest of us, just openly admit that we grieve with you, but we do not fully understand the grief you bear. And we don't want to pretend to understand. And so if you need us and you need something, we want to be people to whom it is safe to say, the suicide of my child or the suicide of my parent or the suicide of my friend, that never gets better. There are some things about that that never get better. Questions that are never answered, certainly not in this life. And so I want to remind you that you have not only eternal value, obviously, but you have temporal value. Your life has value right here and right now, even if it doesn't feel like it. Your life has value and you have meaning and you are loved and beloved. And so I want to affirm that today as we enter into what is going to sound like, you know, at least on some level, some bad news. And I don't want us to be purveyors of bad news. I want us to be people who are purveyors of the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ and bring that good news of the gospel to bear on everything, even the headline news of the day. So as we turn to what is going on in Syria, and particularly our hearts breaking for churches in northeastern Syria, Christians whose stories are now coming out of these zones through the Outreach Foundation or Preemptive Love or others who are on the front lines there and aren't leaving. As we hear these stories of what is happening in northeastern Syria, let us be mindful that we're going to spend eternity with these brothers and sisters in Christ. And let us also be mindful that this is the day the Lord has made, and we will rejoice and be glad in it. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. When I come back, I'll be talking with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine about Syria and other things going on in the Middle East.
We'll be right back.
All right, Drew Griffin is back. He is from Providence Magazine. You can follow him on Twitter at DG_NYC. Welcome back, my friend.
Good morning, Carmen. How are you?
I am well. I think that one of the challenges that we face as Christians today is expressing the reality that it is well with my soul, even though things are not well.
Right. Yeah, that's the constant struggle.
Right. I mean, there's just a gravity to things in the world today. So you and I are going to turn to headlines out of Syria. Why don't you give us the update this morning? It's a very dynamic situation. And so give us an update and then your perspective on it.
Sure. Yeah, this is a situation that's been changing rapidly over the last 2 weeks since President Trump announced in a surprising fashion via tweet that he would be withdrawing U.S. troops from Syria, and that it was he had talked to the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who had indicated that Turkey was going to head into Syria and kind of clean out the border region between Syria and Turkey of Kurds that had kind of set up this semi-autonomous sub-governmental kind of area there in northeast Syria. And so we withdrew our troops. Turkey invaded. This has led to a mass exodus of people who are Kurds, who are kind of fleeing at this point for their lives. Some of them are fighting. Some of them are fleeing. Some of them are staying to help out Christian villages. Some of them are staying to help man detention centers where thousands of ISIS fighters are being detained. So in the midst of all of this kind of chaos, the U.S. Kind of backtracked a little bit, went in and brokered a ceasefire between Turkey and the Kurds in order to allow for a more peaceful withdrawal from the region by the Kurds. That ceasefire expired yesterday. A new ceasefire has taken an effect that was brokered by Russia and Turkey. And then that now we have Russia that is kind of patrolling the area there, occupying former U.S. bases and basically trying to ensure some level of stability in the region as the ceasefire holds. And again, the Kurds are being asked to kind of leave this area that they've been occupying. It's a complicated situation. There are a number of actors that are in play. But it definitely has been a chaotic 2 weeks that has seen the creation of at least now probably any estimates say 160,000 to 270,000 new refugees, the repatriation of hundreds if not thousands of ISIS fighters that were previously detained that have now broken out of their detainment or fled from their prisons and kind of repatriated out into the area that they formerly controlled. So it's a dynamic situation, and it's a troubling situation to be sure.
So probably like other Christians, I have emails and certainly communications via Facebook and Twitter from ministries in the region, Christians in the region, churches in the region. And the kinds of things that they are saying about what is happening on the ground are different than maybe what we're hearing from mainstream media. And so, Preemptive Love posted yesterday this desperate call for, help for their team in northeastern Syria, basically saying, look, all our food is gone. There are 300,000 people running for their lives. And we hear them saying that the ceasefire Maybe the ceasefire holds in terms of actual military action by Turkey, but they're certainly not experiencing, the kind of peace that existed in the region prior to all of this. We're also hearing from the Outreach Foundation, which is in relationship with Christian churches in the region, appealing on behalf of pastors and their churches. Christians are not leaving. They're saying this is our home. This is the place where God called us to be light in darkness. Drew, I imagine that we are going to see significant trauma in this region after whatever period of time Turkey decides it has by its own view of grace given for people to leave, and people who do not leave, I fear for them.
Yes, I mean, I think there are a number of fears that have to kind of attend this this moment. The first is the fear of ethnic cleansing that I think is a very real fear. Turkey is has a long history of unfortunately perpetrating genocide and engaging in ethnic cleansing, removing entire populations from areas within Turkey. And it has a long and contentious relationship with the Kurds, especially. There are millions of Kurds that reside in kind of eastern Turkey. There is a contentious relationship there. And so they, you know, the fear is that as Turkey moves into this this area, this kind of border area between Syria and Turkey, that there is potential for unmonitored and you know, ethnic cleansing, or at least kind of pernicious activity, whether it's just abuse or the forcible removal of, you know, people from their homes. So ethnic cleansing, I think, is a fear. Christian persecution is definitely a fear. Turkey is no great respecter of religion and, you know, religious pluralism, or Christianity for that matter. This, of course, is the nation that had imprisoned, you know, Pastor Andrew Brunson, that we have, you know, followed the story over the last couple of years, who was released last year. And so there is fear that not only from the Turks that there could be potential persecution, but also from ISIS, which is still very much present in the region. Many of these ISIS detainees that have been released, the fear is that they will begin to kind of reassemble and reorganize, and could lead to the persecution again of their of the Christian villages and the villages in general that they had been perpetrating before. And then the fear just of increased refugees, and that the fact that a lot of the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that have been present in this region since the beginning of the Syrian civil war and, you know, the early 2010s, 2011, 2012, and the fight with ISIS that the United States and its allies engaged in to purge the area of the Islamic State. Both of those huge kind of conflicts created humanitarian disaster, the largest relocation of individuals since World War II. And so a lot of these non-governmental organizations that have been present there, since the situation has gotten much more dire and much more dangerous, have had to flee. I mean, they have to remove their own personnel for their own personnel's protection. So it's really left up to the communities, some of which, like you said, Preemptive Love has, one of the organizations there has indicated, they are staying and they are trying to care for the Christians in the region. But then a lot of the NGOs have actually left and then pulled out.
Which we can, you know, we can understand both, both perspectives. Okay, Drew Griffin and I are going to take a very brief break. When we return, we're going to turn our attention to what is happening in Iraq and Iran and Israel. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Because what if your blessings come through raindrops? What if your healing comes through tears? What if
continuing my conversation with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. You can check out what they are doing at providencemag.com. Drew, let's touch on Iraq and Iran, and then let's do some, you know, kind of take the take the bigger picture view of what's happening. And so start where you want to on Iraq and Iran.
Sure. Well, we've mentioned before, I think, in previous episodes, that we've talked about the fact of the massive kind of security crisis that's occurring in Iran right now. There are a number of protests throughout the country. Hundreds have died. Thousands have been injured. Really, the protests starting at the beginning of this month, the beginning of October. And they are protesting corruption. They are protesting political instability. They are seeking political reform and, you know, greater kind of control over their country. And this is happening, you know, amidst all of the other instability in the region. Like we've said, with now we have, you know, Kurdish refugees fleeing into the country. We have U.S. troops trying to find a new home since they pulled out of their bases in Syria. And, you know, part of this regional instability is Iran. And Iran has a rising influence within Iraq. They have militias that are present in the country. Some of these militias have been present at these rallies and at these protests, and they've been fomenting greater chaos, firing into crowds, and just basically sowing greater instability within the country. And so Iran is really trying to reach into every area of the region, trying to become a main player in the region, whether it's Syria, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Iraq. Iran is present. Their militias through Hezbollah and other organizations are present, and they're putting snipers on the rooftops in Baghdad. So it's something, again, that we have to be mindful of, definitely prayerful about. But not ignorant of the fact that there are bad actors in this region that aren't neutral, that aren't sitting on their heels. They are actively trying to seed the region with chaos for their own political benefit.
Well, and when we talk about a Christian worldview, we also need to not be ignorant would be one word, but Pollyannish would be another. These are people with Islamist visions of what the world is to be like. And so for those of us who have a different vision for the world and peaceably living together with those with whom we disagree and may never agree, I think we just need to be mindful that the shifts that we see taking place, not only in the Middle East, but wow, around the world today, there's just a lot of political chaos. There are worldview implications for all of these in all of these places and for all of these people.
Yes, and I think the kind of big picture that I want people to focus on, that one of the reasons why we have Providence and one of the themes that we kind of try and draw out is that the world operates under systems of values, and they're competing systems of values, and they're not morally neutral. These systems. It's not just politics. It's not just economics. It's not just ethics, and it's ethics and morality. These systems are informed. Whether it's Chinese communism, whether it's Iranian Shia Islam, whether it's the political Islam of Turkey or Russia's kind of weird, totalitarian kind of dictatorship type state, all of these systems are informed by moral values. And the morality here, the moralities that are being played out are not equal. And what we have to realize is that those with the power and those who are present and those who are in charge get to set the terms and the values that rule these systems. And our absence, the absence of the good, I think, that we represent in America and our own particular values is an opportunity for the evil that we oppose to flourish. And while all of that may sound dire, to your very point in your opening segment in your intro, of just that this can lead maybe to some sort of depression or this fatalism or hopelessness, we face these massive problems. But we do so, especially as Christians, with the knowledge that there is an ultimate truth that will prevail, regardless of the nations that rise and the nations that fall, that there is a truth and a word that remains eternal, and that we're not powerless in this world, that God gives us tools, the governments that we receive, the governments that we control here in the United States, is a tool that God has given us, he says in Romans 13, to administer justice and to punish those who do wrong and to reward those who do right. And so it's a responsibility that we have. And it's Christians, I think, have to be the ones that speak into this time, giving a realistic assessment of what's going on in terms of the real fallenness of man, but also hopefully a hopeful assessment of the fact that we have this power, we have this ability, we have this mandate, and that we have a future that's ultimately secure, and that hope is what sustains us. So these are massive problems, but God hasn't given us a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power. And I think Christians of all people shouldn't be people who worry, but people who are full of hope and people who are full of a realistic optimism that can help inform the people around us.
Very, very, very well said. Thank you so much, Drew. I think that framing it in that way, these are competing systems of values. It's not morally neutral. They are totalizing systems. And we have to, as Christians, understand Christianity as a totalizing system as well, and be able to talk about the gospel as impacting everything. So thank you so much for what you do every day at Providence Mag. You guys can check it out at providencemag.com. That's where you can find Drew Griffin. You can also find him on Twitter, DG_NYC. Thank you so much. All right, so Japan and Thailand, both back in May, elevated individuals to the status of kings. And they actually, these processes are actually the deification of human individuals. They regard these men literally as gods. They are some of the oldest monarchies in the world. And in May, we acknowledged the coronation of an emperor in Japan and a king in Thailand. And now the king in Thailand is is up to something new. So we're going to take an Asia pivot here in just a moment. We're going to talk about, if you see the world through a lens where you are the god, literally the deity in human form, how does that affect your relationships? Maybe even most significantly, your relationship with your wife. Peter Kapsner will be here. He and I are going to till this particular 51 of the 50 Shades of Truth. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Do you know someone who can tell a great story? A story where everyone hangs on every word and the ending has a real punch? Hi, I'm Callie Breeze with Thrivent, helping you be wise and thrive. Storytelling is an art, whether it's funny, dramatic, happy, or sad. So if someone were to tell a story about your life, what would they say? Maybe you're doing a great job raising your children, or you're considered very successful in your career. But really, it's up to you to write your story. God gives you the freedom to make choices, to use your talents, to follow His calling, to live your life in a way that honors Him. When you know your life's purpose, decisions about everything else fall into place, like how you should use all your God-given resources, including your time, talents, and finances. So consider your own story. When it's aligned with God's purpose, you'll find yourself living with more contentment, confidence, and generosity.
Peter Kapsner is back, and he and I are going to talk about a man who a country considers a deity, and then how that affects the human relationships around him. Peter Kapsner, welcome back.
Thanks, Carmen. Great to be with you, as always.
Sometimes the headlines deliver unto us irresistible news from around the world, where people really do see things in a radically different way than we see things through our biblical or Christian worldview. And so in Thailand, back in May, they crowned a new king. And that king, people may or may not remember, during the ceremony of his coronation, he is actually deified. In this coronation ceremony in May, the people of Thailand regard this individual as having become a deity. And there were things surrounding his coronation, like it had to happen precisely at 10:09 in the morning because that was the designated time by the royal augur, who's basically an astrologer. There was a 9-tiered umbrella involved that I don't know the significance of, but there are other pieces like a 16-pound, 2-foot-tall diamond-studded crown that this man then has to wear. And, you know, I don't know, 16-pound crown on your head, that better be well balanced. just a few days prior to his coronation, he took a wife. Now, the wife that he took was actually his royal consort prior to him marrying her, and it's his fourth wife. Well, in addition to taking a fourth wife, he took another royal consort. That's what we're talking about today. Tell people what has happened to the former royal consort of the Thai king who the whole country considers a deity.
Well, she was sort of summarily dismissed in a sense of grasping after power that was not seen to be hers, especially if she's going to grasp after power for a king who is seen as deity and has been divinized in that situation. And so there's lots to get into there. If I could just back up for a minute, Carmen, I think it's really interesting that you noted that the king is seen as a deity figure. And before we say, gosh, that's so exotic, that's so weird, I think we have different gradations of this that sort of make their way into many different faith and or country kinds of nationalistic practices. And so if we even just think about our own Christian faith and our Christian history, it isn't anywhere near as extreme as what we're talking about here with the Thailand king. But the idea that the Pope, for example, within the Catholic Christian tradition, it speaks from the lips of God. There's a theological principle that is called ex cathedra, which in the Latin means that when the Pope speaks, it literally is as if the words are coming from God himself. And that doesn't mean that the Pope is as a deity, of course, but in sort of the equivalence of saying that when the Pope speaks, it's infallible and representative of heaven itself, there is an authority that can't be questioned. And if you want to try to usurp that authority, you're obviously going to be in big trouble, including excommunication. But in Protestant churches, it functions the same way in a very different regard, in the sense that I have been part of church staffs and consulting in churches for the better part of the last 25 years. And one of the very common things that I hear is the idea that the senior pastor sort of has a more brightly burning bush than any other pastor, or any other parishioner within the body. And they hear from God on a regular basis far more clearly and with far more authority than anyone else might within that organization. So you're again talking about giving authority to somebody because they have some sort of special relationship with God at the very least, or now in the case of this Thailand king, you have the situation where he has become a deity himself. And so what we're really talking about here is an unquestioned chain of authority. And when the consort decided to sort of usurp all of this and become queen herself, she was then dismissed from the court. And boy, there is a lot that we can get into there in terms of views of women, in terms of women seen as property, all of those kinds of realities. So that's maybe a good starting place for this conversation.
Okay, so we could pull, there's like a 50 threads in there that I just wrote down that we could pull. I think that when I look at this story, particularly in the way that the secular media is covering it, I find myself a little surprised that there seems to be no concern for her as an individual. You know, in our culture, a person aspiring to elevate herself would probably not be used, or the kind of language that's used related to this woman would probably not be used in an American context in relationship to a woman seeking to elevate herself. And a man who was treating women like this would not be regarded by the media in such positive tones. And so it is interesting to me how the media covers stories around the world and seems to understand the context, the theological context, and the historical and cultural context, and does not question it, where here they would be questioning it all day long.
Right. And I think it's interesting when you see the treatment of women in this situation and the way this whole thing is being portrayed. I mean, again, if we wanted to sort of back up a little bit and look through the lens of history, I think one of the common patterns that you see through history, and I explore this in my gender and my sexuality classes a lot, is that the most common thing that we see between men and women in history is sort of this misogynistic kind of tendency that can manifest itself in outright hatred of women, or just simply the significant disempowerment of women into any kind of place of status, power, and authority. And you see that throughout almost every faith tradition, including the Judeo-Christian one. You certainly see it in this situation as well. And I think, Carmen, we live in a time right now where there is a significant global shift happening related to the treatment of women. And yet it does seem to be sort of pick and choose a little bit. And there's some sort of sympathy given to this king in this particular situation who has dismissed this woman. And in many other contexts, boy, you would see the exact, different backlash to that situation. But I don't know how it all fits in when you look through the lens of history, the way women have been treated historically. But one of the things we do explore in my class is that in the curse of Genesis 3, we see that there seems to be a special enmity is the word, or a special hatred that the serpent has for the woman, primarily because she is sort of the provider of the seeds for the future that are meant to be rightly ordered within God's kingdom. She also is the seeds of the future for the Messiah. And I don't know, I can't say that that explains the hatred of women in general, sort of the life that is brought. But boy, it sure is interesting to watch it in a lot of different global contexts, both through history and in today's day and age.
All right, one more thread to pull on this subject, and then after the break, we'll move to the subject of when life begins, because that's an interesting conversation in the culture today as well. I think it's important that we remind people what Scripture says. We are a royal priesthood. We are a holy nation. We are a people belonging to God. And when we read or hear what's happening around the globe, particularly in places where the gospel is not the operational worldview of a people group. And so, you know, certainly that would be true in Thailand. It's important for us to recognize that we have royal language and we have priesthood language and we have sanctity of marriage language. And we have language that puts men and women on a par as image bearers, co-equal image bearers of God, and who stand on equal footing in need of salvation at the cross, and who certainly stand on equal footing in the kingdom of heaven. And so I do think that for those of us who are seeking to speak into the cultural conversations of the day, we have biblical language to use here.
We do. We do. And I think what you just pointed out is so helpful, is that in an increasingly relativistic world where sort of your truth is your truth and my truth is my truth, and who are we to say and what are we to say, I think there is an invitation here, Carmen, to suggest that the incredible Christian witness of men and women working side by side together as royal priests on behalf of God's kingdom, and the sanctity of a single male, single female marriage coming together, these are ways of life that I think you can objectively say really are potentially much healthier and much better for the world as a whole than many other ways of life might be. So this does give us a bit of an invitation, whether we're listening this morning, you and I thinking about these things, to just say, wait a second, maybe not everything is relativistic. And why might the Christian way of life in terms of men and women be a way of life that would be intriguing actually to the entire world?
Amen. All right, Peter Capstan and I are going to be right back. Next up, we are going to talk about when life begins. Apparently, biologists actually overwhelmingly know that it begins where those of us from a biblical worldview also acknowledge it begins. It begins at conception. Not very popular in the culture today. Peter Capstan and I will be talking about that up next here on Mornings with Carmen. All right, that music is an indication that Peter's in Scotland, coming to us via Skype this morning. Peter, welcome back.
Love it. Yeah, thanks. You know, literally, they play the bagpipes in the city as you walk through the city. It's absolutely brilliant.
I don't even, I'm just going to leave that alone. I'm not picking that scab.
That's fair enough.
Okay, don't bring me any haggis. Okay. So a gentleman named Steve Jacobs was awarded a PhD from the University of Chicago Department of Comparative Human Development, which we could probably spend time talking about. His dissertation was sort of repackaged as a paper or a publication entitled Balancing Abortion Rights and Fetal Rights, a Mixed Methods Mediation of the U.S. Abortion Debate. Now, that is a mouthful. Essentially, what he reported is that there's actually a majority of Americans on both sides of the abortion debate who are absolutely enthusiastic about coming up with a compromise position for us as a nation to get beyond the sort of trench warfare between, you know, let's say Planned Parenthood and then those who would be advocates that abortion should be illegal in every circumstance for everyone. And so a majority of Americans, this is what his research found, would support a comprehensive policy that provided entitlement for pregnant women, improved the adoption process, permitted abortion in extreme circumstances, but restricted elective abortion after the first trimester. Like, a majority on both sides of the political aisle would support that. That is not what the media was most interested in. What the media was most interested in was that his findings of 96% of the more than 5,000 biologists who responded to his survey viewed human life beginning at fertilization.
Yeah, boy. I mean, it's almost like the media treats that as if it would be a scandal, right? This is scandalous information that biologists would be, you know, so forthright in their opinions about when life begins. And it's a classic example, Carmen, at least the first thing that I thought about is how life within academic institutions and where research is happening is often terribly disconnected for both good and ill for society from life in the culture. And so a couple other examples prior to this one would be that theological conversations and biblical conversations that are happening in academia are often, they don't usually trickle into the church, if at all, for even up to 30 to 50 years historically, when there's changes about understandings of the kingdom or new things that are happening that might be terribly helpful for the church, they often don't bridge that gap. Or in the same gender relationship, gay and lesbian conversation in our country right now, most, if not all, biologists would agree that you don't receive either a gay gene or a straight gene at birth. There's no genetic code. And yet, popular culture would suggest that people are either created straight or gay or any number of different kinds of genders these days. That cultural idea is incredibly different than the research idea right now. And that, for some reason, we can't bridge that gap. And that's classic here, too. It was about, I think, slightly around 5,000 biologists or so agreed with life beginning at fertilization. And yet, when there is a national media narrative that is bent in a different direction, that kind of information is going to be disregarded. It's going to be seen as scandalous. It isn't something that we adjust to. And I don't know about you, Carmen, but I guess I can also fall guilty sometimes of not adjusting my points of view to new information. But boy, is this just a clear example and a very extreme one at that.
So I'm going to read a paragraph from this article. So Steve Jacobs surveyed thousands of Americans and found that most Americans believe the question of when life begins is an important aspect of the abortion debate, 82%. And most believe that Americans deserve to know when human life begins in order that they could give informed consent to abortion procedures. Most Americans also believe a human's life is worthy of legal protection once it begins. So there's 93%. So if we could figure out the answer to the question of when life begins, the abortion debate, particularly in the legal, the legal part of the abortion debate, would, for most Americans, at least by what they imagine, this is what they say anyway. Like, right? Who knows if we come up with the answer to the question that life begins at conception. Will they actually be satisfied with that? And I think that's the itch that he's scratching here, because when he asked who would be the most qualified to answer the question of when life begins, overwhelmingly Americans chose biologists from the list of options. And so, you know, he then surveyed biologists and they overwhelmingly say that, you know, that human life begins at fertilization.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's fascinating, I just read a quote from a book. I believe it was Nancy Piercy's book, Love Thy Body, but I'd have to look back to make sure I have the correct book. But related to life at conception and what science is discovering, this is a very new thing, and it really did take my breath away. She writes that scientists recently discovered that when a sperm meets an egg, an explosion of tiny sparks erupts from the egg at the exact moment of conception. Science have even captured these astonishing fireworks on film. And then they say, quote, to see the zinc radiate out in a burst of light from each human egg was breathtaking. Human life literally begins with a bright flash of light. And Carmen, boy, you can tie that biology into the theology of what light means in the biblical text and let there be light. When God says that at the moment of the conception of creation, there's more in that word light than just an idea of physical light. It is the idea of a God-permeated reality that continues to bring everything into being, which is why sun, moon, and stars show up much later. They're the actual physical light, but the light of God is something that is infused into the reality of life, and we see that infusion sort of in these physical sparks at the moment of conception. It's fascinating what science continues to learn that is really pushing hard on what has been an abortion understanding in our country for the better part of 40 years or so, and it's continuing to chip away at that over and over. I think we're going to see some significant effects of this if we do have a Supreme Court conversation about this in the next couple of years on Roe v. Wade. I can't imagine that lawyers aren't going to pick up on the biology of this on some level and seeking to overturn that ruling.
Yeah, absolutely. And the research that Nancy Piercy is relying on there is actually from Northwestern University. They actually filmed they filmed it. They filmed it when this takes place, and the eggs that that actually burn brighter are the ones that are going to yield a healthy embryo. It's just really, it's a really, really incredible scientific advancement, and it supports the theology which declares that life begins at conception. And so I think that when science supports theology, you know, we ought to be celebrating it. And when science does not support theology, we ought to be seriously considering it. Like, right? This is a conversation we ought to be able to have as thinking people.
Boy, wouldn't that be a good conversation for another time, is just the intersection of science and theology. The two don't have to be at odds with each other. I get it when science is trying to drive God out of the equation, but I'm sure you know, and I know many, many scientists that are counting for God within the equation, and we don't have to live in this sort of polarized reality. Either you pick science or faith. The two can really interact beautifully in some wonderful ways.
Absolutely. All right, Peter Kapsner, thank you so much. That will be a conversation for another day. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. All right, tying together the conversation at the beginning and the end of this hour, God is the giver of life, and God is the one who alone has authority to bring a life to an end. And so when we have conversations with the next generation, and frankly with the generation that is ahead of us, when at both ends of life, when we are considering the value of life and we are considering our authority in it, you know, when you're having conversations with a person who is considering taking their own life, you know, that is a conversation that's an opportunity to bring God to bear. God is the one who gave the life, and God is the one alone who has the right to take that life away. That is true at the end of life as well. And so when we get into conversations about euthanasia, when we get into conversations about death with dignity and the other euphemisms of our generation, we need to remember that God is the giver of life and alone the one with the authority to take it away. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. We got another hour up next. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.